So tonight I want to talk about something called Vedana, mental formation. The word Vedana is often translated as feeling tone because there's no really good English translation to it. I could even have entitled this talk The Importance of Vedana in the Buddhist Teachings. But before I even go to that, I want to say that in what I'm teaching is very particular to the Theravada Buddhist view of Vedana. And you may have heard of the term Vedana in other contexts and other traditions. And from the Theravada point of view, those other views are based on mistranslations. Basically, Vedana has a very specific meaning, and as the original Pali teachings got translated to Sanskrit, and then eventually even into Tibetan and Chinese and Japanese, they lost the meaning of Vedana, according to Theravada teachings. Basically, let me read the sutta here, because this is a. So basically, the thing I want to mention is, this is something that is central to the Buddhist teachings, because it appears in three really distinctly different places that are all central to the Buddhist teachings. The first thing I'm going to do is read part of the teaching on Vedana from the Satipatthana Sutta. Basically, the entire second foundation of mindfulness is simply Vedana. Just that. He separates it out from everything else. And then you see similar things in two other key teachings I want to talk about as the evening goes on. One is the idea that was unique to the Buddhist teachings called codependent arising, where Vedana is one of the 12 factors in codependent arising. And it's also one of the five things in the teachings on the five aggregates of clinging. So here's three key teachings, and Vedana plays a prominent role in all three of these teachings. That's why I wanted to call this whole talk The Importance of Vedana in the Buddhist Teachings, because it's central to understanding what he's trying to get across. But let me read them from this first bit from the Satipatthana Sutta. When feeling a pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unpleasant feeling. When feeling a neutral feeling, he knows, I feel a neutral feeling. So first of all, even here, the translation feeling, it probably should be feeling tone. And what we're trying to do is separate this out as it became understood in later teachings, later translations of the Buddhist teachings, to be like feelings, like emotion. Okay? Whereas feeling tone is a very precise mental formation that only has the three valences, I suppose you could call them. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. That's it. And basically, every time something arises at one of the six sense doors, every time we're conscious of something arising at one of the six sense doors, the first thing that always happens is Vedana arises, the mental formation of Vedana. And so it's like in a sense, this reactive energy, this reactive mental formation that is really simple and quite quick right after, but separate from the actual arising itself, that has it's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. So you can see this is very different from feelings, which has this sort of very broad understanding of what when you think of feelings, we think of all kinds of varieties of things. Whereas Vedana is very precisely just these three things. And the thing is, there's something arises at one of the sense doors, and we'll talk more about that as when we talk about the 12 steps of codependent arising. But something arises at one of the sense doors, and then this reaction, this mental reaction, goes, "Oh, I like that. I don't like that." Or, "Duh, who cares?" Right? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And it always happens. And the thing is, when the Vedana is pleasant, our habitual patterns of reaction to that Vedana arising are, I like that, I want more. Clinging, grasping. When it's unpleasant, it's like, ooh, don't want that. And when it's neutral, it's basically, duh, who cares? Let's go find something more interesting. Those are how we always end up reacting. And instead, what the Buddha is suggesting here is that we actually tune into the Vedana itself. Because what often happens is Vedana happens so quickly that we miss it completely, and we're tuning into the reactive energy, the reaction to the Vedana, which is a reaction to the actual arising at the sense door. And this is how we get caught. And once again, I'm going to talk about this a lot more when we talk about codependent arising. But the beauty of Vedana is, it's really simple. There's really only one of three things that's going to happen. Something arises. We notice it's pleasant. We notice it's unpleasant. We notice it's neutral. Neutral's the hard one, by the way, because we tend to gloss over neutral things. We don't notice them at all because they're so neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, at least they have some charge to them, and we connect to them a little more. And here's the other interesting thing, well, two other interesting things about Vedana in this context. One is that we start to think, if we're not careful, well, when that kind of thing arises, then the pleasant Vedana will always arise. So we sort of conflate the arising of whatever it is that happened at the sense door. We conflate that with the Vedana and make it into a package, like one thing is always the same. But the truth is often quite different. We have different Vedana will arise depending on causes and conditions that were there before that arising. For instance, and this is one of my favorite examples. Imagine I just gave you a bowl of your favorite thing to eat. Doritos, ice cream. I just had this great gluten-free vegan chocolate cake that was just like unbelievable. Anyhow, something like that. You got this bowl of stuff or this plate of stuff, and it's like, first bite is just absolutely pleasant. And maybe for the entire eating of the entire plate or bowl, it's like, oh, pleasant, 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 pleasant. You finish that, and then immediately I take the empty bowl away and give you another bowl. And it's not the same. That pleasant thing now is sort of like, oh, well, it's another bowl of my favorite stuff, so I'm going to eat it, right? But you sort of, by the end of that second bowl, it's going, oh, well, okay, I've had enough of this. And I take it away and I give you a third bowl. Eat this. And all of a sudden, the Vedana, what arises is unpleasant. Ugh, more chocolate cake. I've already had 2 pieces. Ugh. That immediate reaction will be unpleasant. So the object, whatever that object is, and the Vedana are two separate things. That because the causes and conditions, I mean, the causes and conditions when I gave you the first bowl was like I just gave you a bowl. But then the second time was like I gave you another bowl and you'd already had one bowl. Very different causes and conditions. And by the time the third bowl was like, oh my God, he just gave me another bowl. Oh. It's very, once again, very different causes and conditions. And that's, we have to really understand this, that these are separate things. There's the arising due to causes and conditions of something arising in the sense store, and then there's the Vedana that arises as a result of that thing being there and the causes and conditions that preceded that. The beauty of this, there's two things here that are really wonderful about being able to actually note Vedana, note the actual arising of Vedana. One is that we start to see our habitual reactive patterns. Because the Vedana is there, and then boom, we're into a reactive pattern just like that. But the Vedana itself is really simple. And if we can learn to just tune into the Vedana a little bit more often. And we start to see that it's changing all the time. Even something as simple as this changes all the time. It's totally impermanent based on causes and conditions. It's never the same. It's not, no guarantees that it'll be the same from one time to the next. And these are important things that we start to understand. Want to read a little bit from Joseph here. This is Joseph Goldstein's book on mindfulness, and he talks about this quite extensively. And he's talking about this idea. Meditation provides us an opportunity to observe the mind's reactions to different kinds of things. How does the mind respond when a pleasant sexual feeling arises in the body or pleasant fantasies in the mind? Do we indulge or resist? Are we mindful and non-reactive, seeing clearly their impermanent nature? How does the mind respond to unpleasant feelings of pain or discomfort? How does the mind respond when we're ill? The Buddha gives us some direct instructions here. You should train like this. My body may be sick, yet my mind will remain unafflicted. So often we put certain situations out of our practice. When they are either particularly pleasant or particularly unpleasant. I found that especially with the latter, it's helpful to see them as being training for dying. We would all like to die with a peaceful state of mind, but it is likely that when we're dying, there will be some amount of pain or discomfort of one kind or another. If we have trained ourselves to be mindful of these kinds of feelings, both physical and mental, during the ordinary experience of our lives, then at the time of death, our minds and hearts will abide in a place of great ease. Isn't this an interesting thought? That we're actually, we could look at all of this practice as training for the moment when we die. Because we're all going to die. I mean, that's guaranteed. But how we die, what's the state of our mind at that point? In certain traditions, especially in Hindu traditions, the state of the mind at the moment you die is really critical because it determines what happens next. And in the Hindu traditions, if as you're dying, you're repeating your mantra, which would require a great deal of concentration, considering all the other stuff that's going on. That's extremely auspicious. reminds me, I don't know, I'm a big Gandhi fan. I have a huge library of books about Gandhi. And what Gandhi, when he died at the end, he was shot by an assassin as he was going to, give a Dharma talk, essentially. And in the movie Gandhi, which is a great movie, by the way, there's this big thing they do right at this point. It's a big mistake, because there's Gandhi. He's shot, and what does Gandhi say? He says, "Oh God!" Which is like an exclamation of surprise, right? Actually, what he said was, "Jai Ram." Just repeated his mantra. Gives you an indication of where his mind was, right? It's interesting, these little things that you see sometimes. And he was, his all of his practice, because he practiced all the time, prepared him for his death. Even at the moment of death, when he was shot by an assassin in the middle of a crowd of people, what came to his mind was Jai Ram. Anyhow. So that's just, so this is somewhat of an aside, but I find it a fascinating aside, so I had to go there. What can I say? Okay. So then we go on to the teachings on codependent arising. And this codependent arising is a teaching that's totally unique. This is something that the Buddha taught that didn't exist as a teaching in any other tradition at the time of the Buddha. This was like unique to the Buddha. And it's key to understanding the psychology behind what he's talking about. So first of all, what does codependent arising mean? It basically means, to put it in simple symbolic logic terms, if A happens, then B must have happened. And if B happens, then A must have happened. So it goes in both directions. If this happens, then this has to have happened. This will happen. And if this happens, it's because that happened. It's logically stated in both directions. They're tightly linked together. And these are causal links that work in both directions. 12 steps. I'm not going to do all 12 steps. I'm going to do most of them, however. Basically, the first one that we want to talk about is causes and conditions are such that something arises at one of the sense doors. And I want to point out, I have a little note here in my notes, this may or may not be because of karma. It might just be, as I've talked about before, you have indigestion, or who knows? Something happens so that something arises at one of your sense doors. That's all, just one of those things. And then consciousness at the sense door arises because what's called all three factors are present, which is called, in the literature, in the tradition, it's called contact. So something's arising at the sense door, but contact has to arise. What's the next step along the line? And what does contact mean? Contact means that three things were present. One, there was, let's take sound because it's easy. There's a sound wave going through the air. Number one, the actual sound wave was present. Number two, there was a functioning sense organ. Your ear was working. In my case, without my hearing aids, a lot of times they don't work too well anymore. But it's like there's the actual impetus. There's the functioning sense organ, and there is what's called ear consciousness present. And all three of those have to be present for you to actually hear something, for an actual arising of hearing to occur. And that third one you have to think about for a second, but I thought about me as a kid. I was a big, big reader as a kid. And I would be sitting, before a meal or something like that. I'd be with my nose in a book as usual, reading. And my mother would say something like, "Barry, dinner's ready." And I wouldn't react. And then she'd have to say a little louder, "Barry, dinner's ready." And then sometimes she actually had to poke me because I was so absorbed in the book, in the story, that ear consciousness wasn't functioning. Because my concentration was so deeply in the book itself or whatever it was I was absorbing that I wasn't actually hearing. And this is true all the time of all of our sense doors. At various times, they're functioning like the consciousness of that is associated with that particular sense door is functioning or not. All three have to be present. The actual wave or sound or whatever flavor, the functioning sense organ, and the fact that we're conscious in that sense organ area at that time. Then contact arises. It's the next step in this causal chain. Then Vedana arises. As soon as contact occurs, then Vedana arises. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's a separate step. Then the next step is, depending on the Vedana, one of three habitual patterns arise. Grasping at things that are pleasant, aversion to things that are unpleasant, and delusion to things that are neutral. We space out, basically. When things are neutral, it's like, because we're so habitually patterned to want to pay attention to something interesting, even if it's unpleasant. Unpleasant is way better than neutral, right? At least there's some got some action there, right? So our mind just goes off and looks for something more stimulating. That's the common reaction to things that are neutral. In all cases, then, once we've fallen into this reactive pattern, then we cling to the object. We're clinging is beyond the step of reaction into, I want it and I'm going to keep it. It's like there's the reaction and then there's the clinging energy. And clinging is because we want to hold it tight. If it's like pleasant, we notice, oh boy, this is really nice. We're beyond the Vedana, now we're into the actual mental formation of how pleasant it is to have this wonderful piece of chocolate cake. Then, oh, I want to get more of this chocolate cake. This is really good. Or, ooh, don't like this, sour cherry or whatever it is. Using taste again as an object. Or who cares? This is really boring and bland. Let's go find some. Let's put a bunch of salsa on this to make it interesting, or whatever we do. We cling. And the interesting thing is, clinging, when you think of clinging, it's like grasping. Like I want to keep it, I want to have more. But if we're averse to something, we also cling to it. Because if we want to push something away, before we can push it away, we have to make firm contact with it, either at the mental or physical level, right? We have to get a good hold of it so I can push it away. We can't sort of, take one little pinky and go plink and push something away. We got to cling to it so we can fling it away. We always, no matter which of form, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, we cling. Guaranteed. Then clinging, and is the next step on this chain, leads to identification with the object as mine, and the sense of a separate self arises. This is where we've gone beyond just the experience of the object itself to identification with it and it creating a sense of self around it. This is my piece of chocolate cake. It's mine, right? I like chocolate cake. There's self again. And which creates more causes and conditions. This is a step that's called becoming in the traditional explanations. Becoming arises. And we are basically born into another self. Here I am selfing once again, which is the central cause of suffering. Because we keep creating this sense of self, and then we suffer because things change, and all of a sudden I'm not getting any more chocolate cake ever again. For some reason. Because if it's something pleasant, we build up this story about how we'll always have more. I'll always get it again. And then when inevitably it ends, we suffer. And if it's unpleasant, we suffer because we cling to it. We identify with it as I'm the person who never gets chocolate cake. Once again, just an example. And we become the one who's angry or sad or whatever. This is the pattern that we go through zillions of times every day. Something arises at the sense door, consciousness. Where consciousness is there, the three factors are there, Vedana arises, and then we fall into these reactive patterns over and over and over and over, creating more sense of self and creating our own suffering. Here's the good news. There is good news here. It sounds pretty grim up till now. But the good news is, if we can see the Vedana itself arise, if we can actually be mindful of Vedana, then we have a choice to be non-reactive. We can just see the Vedana arise and consciously not react in these habitual patterns. And we start to break this repetitive cycle of over and over and over and over reacting all the time. Just being in this reactive mode all the time. And it allows us to shift our habitual patterns to ones that are non-reactive. But Vedana is the key point where we can actually make that break really cleanly. That's why the Buddhists put so much emphasis on it, because this is the you see this described in some places as the doorway to freedom, and really over dramatic words, but that's what it is. It's the place where we can shift things out of our habitual patterns just by seeing something arises at the level of consciousness. We see the Vedana, and then we go, oh, pleasant. We can note pleasant, we can note unpleasant. You know, neutral. And then that's it. We just don't go any further. We don't fall into the reactive pattern anymore. And one last point here. This is actually quite important, I think. We could turn this into the thought that, oh, pleasant is bad. It's really bad to have pleasant things happen. It's really bad to have pleasant Vedana. This is not true. And actually, I want to read a little bit further into what the sutta actually says first, and then I want to talk about this. What I read was the first part of what the Satipatthana Sutta says. Then actually goes on to say, when feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. And then the same for the other two, for the unpleasant and the neutral. And what he's pointing to here is worldly and unworldly pleasant feelings. So now we're getting a little bit subtle here. But this is really an important point, because part of what happens in this practice is the causes and conditions when a feeling arises become internal. For instance, when you're in deep states of concentration, extremely pleasant. And we have to understand that that pleasantness is an unworldly, pleasant feeling, and it's perfectly okay. In fact, hooray! Because it's those unworldly, pleasant feelings that arise that encourage us to keep practicing, that give us that the sweetness of the practice arises when pleasant, unworldly feelings arise. It doesn't mean we should cling to them, but it's like, okay, it's not like pleasant is bad necessarily. Pleasant is just pleasant and depends on its which side of the coin it is, whether it's unworldly or unworldly. Worldly pleasant, we tend to, even that isn't bad, but that's where we tend to just spin out. But if it's an unworldly pleasant feeling, it can be actually be quite a wholesome experience. I want to read some more from Joseph Goldstein here. We experience non-sensual joy of unworldly pleasant feelings in states of concentration, where the mind is secluded from unskillful states. So he's talking about deeper states of concentration called jhana states, where the kilesas, the unwholesome states, just don't arise. And at that point, we start to feel the joy of this, what's it called, it's a secluded mind. At first, our minds are often restless and agitated, jumping from one thing to another, reacting to various pleasant and unpleasant feelings that arise. At a certain point, whether for short periods or sustained ones, the mind settles down, resting easily on the object of attention, carried on the current of mindfulness. There's an ease and pleasure here much greater than our usual sense delights. There's a greater sense of unification. This is really important, that it's okay to feel these pleasant feelings. That it's not like, oh, I'm getting it. The trick, of course, is we start to feel these pleasant feelings in our practice, and we get attached to them. And we start practicing to create that really pleasant, unworldly, pleasant sensation again. This is the danger, of course, of practice, is that these are so attractive, so pleasant. Like nothing you ever experienced before, I guarantee you, that you just want to, oh, I just want that again. I want to have that again and again and again. And we turn the practice into a way to get high. So these are okay, but they're also very attractive and tend towards, if we're not careful, getting stuck here with just again and again and again, skillfully, because we've learned how to do it, end up in these really calm, still states that are sort of a step along the way, but they're not the end of the story at all. But they seem like so glorious. This must be what I was trying to get to. And they're just like, it's like getting addicted to chocolate cake times 10 or 100. But it's the same thing. Still addicted. Still stuck here. And it's just, we have to be careful about it in that sense. Okay.
actually.
This is also what Anilayo has to say in this book, Satipatthana. The conditioning role of pleasant feeling in leading to likes and eventually to dogmatic attachment has some far-reaching implications, but this does not mean that all pleasant feelings have simply to be avoided. In fact, the realization that pleasant feelings are not simply to be shunned was a direct outcome of the Buddha's own quest for liberation. On the eve of his awakening, the Buddha had exhausted the traditional approaches to realization without gaining awakening. While recollecting his past experiences and considering what approach might constitute an alternative, he remembered a time in his early youth when he experienced deep concentration and pleasure, having attained the first absorption, the jhana. Reflecting further on this experience, he came to the conclusion that the type of pleasure experienced then was not unwholesome and therefore not to be an obstacle to progress. The realization that the pleasure of absorption constitutes a wholesome and advisable type of pleasant feeling marked a decisive turning point in his quest. Based on this crucial understanding, the Buddha was soon able to break through to awakening, which earlier, in spite of considerable concentrative attainments and a variety of aesthetic practices, had he been unable to achieve. So that's what Anilaya is saying, is this is how important these things are. That being okay with them, but as I said, not getting attached to them, is what takes us deeper into the practice. Okay. So that's the second place Vedana arises in the Buddhist teachings. The third place is the five aggregates of clinging, which I've spoken of before, but I want to just go over this again because it fits in. Basically, in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is the, Samyutta means the collected discourses, the biggest topic, the biggest collection is teachings on the five aggregates of clinging. This is, the Buddha talked about this more than anything else. And basically, they call it the five aggregates. One of those things is a tricky translation again. The Pali word is kanda. In Sanskrit, it's actually skanda, same sort of thing. Literally, it translates as heaps. Now, so in this teaching, all of experience is divided into five categories or heaps. But I like the word heaps because it's sort of implies a messiness or randomness almost, which, you know, because things are where is this in that heap or that heap? You know, where's the edges of that heap? It's just a bunch of stuff piled up there. And it is the clinging to these experiences that we create, where we create a sense of self, a sense of separateness. That's, because clinging, this is sort of another angle into the teachings on codependent arising. And I want to read once again from the sutta here, because this is another thing that we can pay attention to based on the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is probably the most simple set of instructions of all of them. It's simple in terms of number of words involved, at least. He knows such is material form, such is arising, such is passing away. Such is feeling tone, such is arising, such is passing away. Such is cognition, such is arising, such is passing away. Such are volitions, such they're arising, such they're passing away. Such is consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. So it's just, here's this list, here's the five heaps, the five piles, right? I want to go over them very briefly. First of all, there's material form, stuff. Anything that has a material form or has and so all sense experiences fit here, for instance, all of the five senses. Anything that we think of as a thing fits in here. Then that's the first one. Then the second heap, oh look, it's Vedana again. Same meaning. Vedana, it's a mental formation that has only three valences, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, nothing else. Then we have perception or cognition, which is the next, basically something, there's something that arises at a sense door. Vedana arises. And in this process that we're talking about, then the next thing that arises is perception or cognition. Identifying that thing in some way. I heard a noise, so hearing, pleasant. Oh, that's a blue jay. Or it might be, oh, that's a blue jay, unpleasant. I mean, it depends on how you feel about blue jays, I suppose, or causes and conditions. Maybe you were sleeping and the noise of the blue jay woke you up and now it's really unpleasant. Same day, you hear another blue jay and it's really sweet because, oh, my blue jays come to my feet or something, you know. So once again, it depends on causes and conditions before the thing arose. But it's like that idea that we experience something and then perception. Basically, we go back into our memory banks and go, oh, I know that sound, it's a blue jay. But it's based on its memory that brings about perception. It's where memory fits into all these equations. The thing about perception, by the way, is totally unreliable. We make things up all the time. We think we perceive something. And it's like we're not even close. But because we all have very high opinions of our ability to perceive things, we think we know what we heard or saw or tasted or whatever. Very unreliable. In certain places, perception is called the mirage in certain teachings. Then, after perception, then mental formations, thoughts about what we just experienced arise. And in particular, there's mental formations called intention or volitions, which is another word that sort of means intention. And this is all other mental formations. But the particular emphasis on volition or intention is once again before we actually act in the world in any way through body or speech, intention has to be there. So this is another place where if we can see intention arise, oh, I was just about to whack that person. Maybe I don't have to do that. It's like the intention has to be there before we do anything. Before I can wave my hand like this, I have to have the intention to wave my hand. Otherwise, it never would have happened. So this is why in some texts it's separated out is so important. And then the fifth of these piles is consciousness itself. The sense, the fact that of knowing, the knowingness of what goes on. Consciousness is where we, if even if we can sort of get to the point where we see that all those other things are just impermanent arises, because they all are, consciousness somehow seems permanent and solid. And it's around consciousness itself that we create this sense of a separate self. Because I'm all, that's me, I'm that consciousness. And what we have to see is that consciousness is just this momentary arising based on all these other things that have happened. And then It arises, it's there, it's gone. And then something else arises, and then another moment of consciousness arises. And then something else, and there's another. But these little discrete moments is not. It seems continuous, it seems solid, because it's happening so rapidly. But it's just like that, and that, and that, and that, all the time. It's not a solid, continuous thing at all. And so, if we can see through our practice, and I have had teachers suggest that one thing I could do, if this idea fascinates you, is when you're sitting, your noting simply becomes which heap that was in. Was that something, something that's arising at the sense or a physical thing? Was it the Vedana? Was it, was I just perceiving there? Was I proliferating, having thoughts about it, forming these intentions based on that? Or was that pure consciousness itself? And we can start to learn to separate these things out and see them all. But what happens is as we start to really look and see, oh wait, everything falls into one of these five heaps. Everything, without exception. There's no exceptions here, I'm sorry. Everything falls into one of these five heaps, and there's no self anywhere. There's no separate self anywhere in any of these heaps. It's just stuff that's arising there for a while and it's gone. Everything. And we by sort of looking at it through this particular lens, we start to see that more clearly. Which is why the Buddha spoke so clearly about this so often, because this was the main teaching he gave around how to start to see that this idea of a separate self is an illusion. This is where he came from. The interesting thing, given my talk on Vedana here, is Vedana was the link between the physical and all those mental things. There was physical form, then there's Vedana, and then all these other mental forms arise. And Vedana is the link that connects them together. Just like in the 12 steps on codependent arising, it was the link that went from having stuff happen to how we react to it mentally. This is the key. Once again, the Buddha is showing how important this by separating it out completely from all other mental formations, he's pointing out really clearly how important it is, how being able to understand and experience Vedana separately is an important thing. So, I want to summarize here. Basically, the idea here is Vedana is a unique mental factor that is continually arising, unnoticed. If we don't see Vedana, it has the potential to lead directly to unwholesome habitual patterns of reaction over and over and over again. Learning to notice Vedana as it arises gives us the opportunity to break these unwholesome reactive patterns and consciously shift to more wholesome states of mind. Seems pretty important to me in that sense. So that's what I wanted to get across. Hopefully I've got across the idea of how important I think Vedana is in the Buddhist teachings. I just want to sort of shift gears as I like to do. And I chose this poem, has sort of a Vedana flavor to it in some sense, and that's all. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. It's called I Am Standing. I'm standing on the dunes in the heat of summer, and I am listening to mockingbird again, who is tonguing his embellishments, and in the distance the shy, weed-loving sparrow, who is but one soft song. She sings again and again, and sometimes, something somewhere inside, my own unmusical self begins humming. Thanks for the beauty of the world. Thanks for my life. Which is also what we have to remember. This world is beautiful and we should be thankful for our lives.